Welcome back to the New Book Network. My name is Sarah Patterson, and I'm one of the sociology hosts here. Today, we'll be talking with Michael McCarthy about his book, Dismantling Solidarity, Capitalist Politics and American Pensions Since the New Deal. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Okay, so we're going to start off by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a sociologist, assistant professor of sociology at Marquette University in the Department of Social and Cultural Sciences. I've been there for about 2.5 years. Before that, I did a postdoc in Cologne, Germany at the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Societies. And before that, I got my PhD at NYU in sociology. But I grew up in California. I've kind of long been interested in issues of labor and work, and it's kind of my background.
Great. Thank you. Can you go ahead and tell us a little bit about how this book came about?
Like I said, I've kind of long been interested in work. I grew up in a working class background. Worked in construction for several years before I started taking night classes in college. So when I went back to school, I always kind of had interested in the issues and problems of working people. And when I went to grad school, I started sort of fishing around for a dissertation topic. And was broadly interested in unions and questions about wages and benefits and things like that. And eventually started reading up on retirement issues and pensions. And before I knew it, really, I'd spent about a year and a half of my life just doing reading on, the technical aspects of pensions and retirement systems. And by that point, I'd so many sunken costs, I guess, in it that it kind of became, my expertise. So I didn't really go into grad school thinking I want to write a book about pensions. It just sort of it kind of happened that way as I read more, I sort of got more invested into it, I guess.
Well, let's go ahead and get into the topic of your book, which is Dismantling Solidarity. So first, I'd like to ask, you talk a lot in this book about the structural inequality built in the welfare system and the pension system. Can you speak more about that?
Well, I guess it's helpful just to sort of lay out what the main puzzle of the book is. And one window into this is the 2008 crisis and its aftermath. Basically, what happened between around October of 2007 to October of 2008 is that stocks really plummeted in the U.S. stock market. They fell by about 37.5% over that year. And what this did was it really ate up the retirement savings in many of the private retirement accounts, most of which were things like 401ks and individual retirement accounts. And throughout that year, that really put people that were kind of approaching retirement age at a double disadvantage. On the one hand, they were at risk of losing their jobs, but on the other hand, they were also losing their retirement assets. Overall, if you look at total losses in the U.S., 401ks and individual retirement accounts lost about $2.4 trillion worth of value. And if you can compare that to the OECD, the average loss across the OECD across the OECD in retirement plans was $5.4 trillion. So we had this massive hit in 2008 to the retirement, essentially the retirement plans in the U.S. and abroad. Since then, politicians have kind of painted a rosy picture about their recovery. We saw this under the Obama administration, where we saw that a lot of the assets that were lost were basically recovered as the stock market recovered as well in 2009, 2010, 2011. And now retirement balances in the U.S. are well over $9 trillion. So they're basically right above where they were prior to 2008. And so politicians kind of They look at this and sort of conclude that, see, the problem's fixed. But that's that misses some important facts. One is that most people are basically about 5 years behind in their retirement savings now. So they just have their savings are just up to where they were prior to the crisis, where they should actually be much larger, right? And the second thing is that that is just the average. When we actually break it down, we find that about 45% of people that are relying on private pensions in the U.S., things like 401ks, have actually not seen their retirement savings recover and have actually seen further losses since 2009. And this basically is pointing to a real crisis in retirement, where the Government Accountability Office can find in 2005 that about half of all households age 55 and older don't have any retirement savings at all. So this is just to introduce the puzzle. The puzzle is basically, how did we get here? How did we get to a point in planning for retirement and in distributing retirement income, where the bulk of people are in a very precarious position and are at high risk of not having adequate amount of income during their retirement, and that income itself is actually determined by fluctuations in the market. Like, you know, what you live on when you retire is actually determined by the market rather than by guaranteed institutions and programs that will ensure a certain level of lifestyle after you retire. So the book basically tries to understand how we got to where we are today with respect to that.
Great. Thank you. One of the things you mentioned in your book is that U.S. senior citizens are actually worse off compared to their counterparts around the world. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. In a way, that sort of gets to how the U.S. welfare state compares to welfare states in other places. And the pension system is actually just one aspect of that. So if we think about old age security, we do see that older folks in the U.S. do tend to have higher rates of poverty than in other rich capitalist countries, you know, places in Western and Northern Europe. This is in large part because the American welfare state in general, but also the American retirement security system is a largely a private one. In the U.S., about 45% of retirement income comes from private pensions. Where if we look at the OECD, the average is about 19%, about 19-20%. So despite having this really, you know, we have the Social Security program, right, which is a public pension. Despite having this, still people get a large percentage of their retirement income through private occupational plans or just their own personal thrift. And this is a real contrast. I mean, this is obvious in things like healthcare, where, you know, there's no universal single payer healthcare system that guarantees it. But it's also true in with respect to pensions as well. And this kind of gets at sort of a bigger difference between the American welfare state and the welfare states abroad, which is in the U.S., there's a much greater reliance on where people work for the things that they need in life above and beyond their wage. So for pensions, for healthcare, for eye care, for dental care, a lot of this stuff is got through one's occupation. And the effect of that is that in systems that tend to be more private, the benefits tend to be distributed more regressively. So people that actually have better jobs, that earn more money, are actually more likely to get healthcare benefits and more likely to get good pension benefits, more likely to get dental and eye care than people that are kind of at most risk and need it the most in a way. So that's why you see there's a lot more volatility in both old age income and poverty, but you see this across the spectrum in healthcare outcomes, in access to dental, all these kinds of benefits that tend to to be offered through sort of through the state in places like Northern Europe, but are actually offered through work in the U.S.
Great, thank you for that. One way in that I saw your book contributing to the literature is in talking about the way that the state and policymakers have influenced the pension process. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So the main argument of my book is basically what the book tries to do is it looks at these three key episodes that have moved pension or rather that have moved income distribution for retirement more and more towards the market. So if you know, the subtitle is Capitalist Politics in American Pensions Since the New Deal. Because in the New Deal period, we kind of saw this unfulfilled promise of cradle to grave security, where people, even after their working life, would have a secure existence. And this was kind of the kernel at the heart of the Social Security Act, which was in 1938. You know, it was right at the heart of Roosevelt's idea of freedom from want, right? This one of his four freedoms that he famously talked about. But this was largely an unfulfilled promise. What we saw since the New Deal is the progressive shift away from secure, publicly provided, egalitarian, and universally accessible retirement income towards market mechanisms as the way to deal with retirement insecurity. So while Social Security is a really important program, it basically has to be it has to be supplemented with other forms of income for the elderly. It accounts for about 40% of the average wage earner's income in retirement. So that additional amount that you're living on needs to be supplemented from something else. And so what the book does, it sort of tries to understand how that institution has changed since the New Deal. And what we find is that there's three key changes. The first change is after World War II, where you get the establishment of the private pension system on a large scale. There were private pensions before World War II, but it was really after World War II that you get their establishment on a really large scale. And it's primarily through collectively bargained plans that are being negotiated after World War II between employers and unions. The next episode is basically the financialization of those plans. You see that pension plans and the funds in particular become financialized. Their investment is more and more towards risky stock. They're chasing risk for returns. And this has important implications about sort of how they're attached to financial markets and how those markets then become the determinant for how well the people do that are relying on those plans. And then in the third phase, you see the growth and establishment of 401k plans in the 1970s and 1980s, a move away from what are called defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, which no longer guarantee a certain amount of income for retirees once they stop working, but instead employers put in a certain amount into a fund, oftentimes matching the amount that the employee puts into the fund, and that employee is responsible for investing that fund and growing their nest egg so that they can live off of once they retire. But if the fund, like as happened in 2008, if there's a crisis and the fund sort of gets hit and those investments turn sour, then that's the employee's problem. So this is kind of like the long-term shift that the book is trying to understand. Like, how did we go from a system in which there was the possibility for an egalitarian, I call it solidaristic approach to retirement security, to one where we basically put the onus on individuals, or we are increasingly putting the onus on individuals to come up with their retirement for themselves. And the chapter that you mentioned, chapter three, is basically about that first episode where we find we get the establishment of private pensions. And in that chapter, I explain that basically by doing a historical analysis of Truman and unions in the immediate post-war period. And basically what I find, which is kind of true across all of the chapters, is that the main driving force behind the installment of the private pension system after World War II is actually triggered by politicians themselves. That politicians are kind of intervening into industrial relations, and it's the result of their tinkering that helps establish this private pension system. But the system isn't established because Truman is somehow committed to private pensions. It's established because politicians are trying to manage what they see as perceived crises in American capitalism. In the case of Truman after World War II, we're basically coming out of a war where labor and management relations were being regulated by wartime state institutions, things like the War Labor Board, which kind of kept strike, even though there were some wartime strikes, they kind of kept strikes at a minimum. It sort of kept labor management relations regularized. And after World War II ended, all these institutions were essentially lifted, right? There was no more wartime justification for the state actually enforcing regular production, right? And Truman and, I mean, Northern Democrats, Southern Democrats, and Republicans all recognized that this opened up the possibility for a huge scale in labor management conflict. And they wanted to avoid that at all costs. Most importantly, because they wanted to take advantage of market opportunities in war-torn Europe and Japan. They wanted to sort of build the products and make the things that would help remake those places, and in turn bring more profit back into the U.S. But labor and management were actually not fully on board with this. After the war, we get the eruption of the largest strike wave in U.S. history to that point, which happens despite the fact that the state is trying to enforce sort of like a labor peace. You know, they have this. Truman holds the president's labor management conference, which is specifically intended to get members of the business community and members of labor to sort of agree on a plan for labor peace, and he's unable to secure it. So after that failure in politics, there's this strike wave, and in that strike wave, one of the key things that unions are pushing for is for fringe benefits, in addition to higher wages, things like healthcare plans and pension plans, and employers are perfectly happy to let stock and equipment sit idle and to actually not give in on any of these labor demands during these strikes. They're happy because there's this immediate decline right after the war in demand for their goods because wartime demand has ended. But there's also this influx of war labor that they can run as striking work as strikebreakers if they want. So that there was pretty weak leverage that labor had over employers. So what the state does, how this gets to pensions, is what the state does is that Truman and his agencies actively intervene in these conflicts to pressure firms to adopt private pensions for their employees. And the National Labor Relations Board in 1948 makes a key ruling that pushes employees to negotiate over these plans. And in late 1948, the Supreme Court basically rubber stamps that ruling, which makes it kind of rule of the land. And if you eventually get sort of the employers kind of give in on this, and pensions get sort of get adopted across all these different industries. Now, I'm kind of talking for a while, but just to kind of conclude this, the follow-up question might be, well, why is it that that Truman intervened in support of unions as opposed to intervening to just crush labor's demand or to support firms, for instance, because a lot of Republicans and Southern Democrats during this period were saying, well, we should just, you know, we should move to sort of like shut down these strikes and shut down labor. And this is where the important sort of second part of my kind of theory comes into it, that labor is politicians are intervening because they're trying to manage crises in capitalism. But the way that they actually are intervening is determined by the level of class struggle in that moment. And we see that Truman intervenes in support of labor demands precisely because labor is an important constituency within the Democratic Party at this period. They're turning out large numbers of votes for Northern Democrats in all the major Northern cities. And they're an important feature of Democratic politics. And so while his main goal is to sort of intervene to keep capitalist growth on course, the way he intervenes and sort of how he chooses to do that is shaped by labor's role within the Democratic Party. And that's how we get essentially the installment of the private pension system after World War II.
Great. Thank you. Just to talk more about post-World War II era, you talk about how we moved in that era to private pensions, but you say it's a mistake to think that workers were in control of these new pension systems. Can you say more about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so after you get the installment of the private pension system, it's funded. It's basically a funded system. So employers and sometimes employees are paying into pension funds, which is accumulating money and assets over time. And very quickly, these pension funds become very large. And, you know, it's they go from essentially having, you know, couple billion dollars in the early 1950s to having trillions of dollars by the 1970s and 1980s. So in the very early stages of this, many labor unions recognized that there could be a real strategic advantage to controlling these funds. And unions like the United Mine Workers, and their union leader, John Lewis, pushed very hard to not only establish pension plans, but to control those plans as well. We see the United Steelworkers, the United Auto Workers, a number of major industrial unions, not just trying to win pensions, but trying to control them too. Politicians saw this very early on and saw the real threat in it. And many commented in Congress on the danger of having unions control their funds, because this is a massive pool of capital, right? A massive pool of investment. And there are all sorts of different ways that labor might be able to use them in offensive purposes against firms, as to invest in certain kinds of things that might benefit unions. One congressman said that if unions were able to control these funds, they'd become basically a war chest, and no government would be able to control unions as a result. So politicians intervened very early in trying to wrest possible control of these financial assets away from unions and turn them over to firms. And we see this happen first with the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947. The Taft-Hartley Act is a very famous anti-labor piece of legislation. It does a number of things that are pretty well known. You know, bans secondary boycotts. There was non-communist affidavits that union members had to sign, sort of saying that they were not affiliated in any way with the Communist Party. There was a number of things that it did to try to kind of weaken labor. But one of the things that it did that a lot of people don't talk about is it regulates pensions. And one of the ways that it does that is by imposing rules for how pension boards can be composed. Pension boards are basically the institutions that are set up to govern pension funds, to decide where the money is invested and who's gonna manage the money, what kind of assets the money is gonna be invested in, that kind of stuff. And what the Taft-Hartley Act does is say that pension funds have to be composed of at least 50% employer representatives. So the fund board itself can't be any more than 50% union representatives. Basically, it ensured that unions wouldn't be able to kind of control these funds. And as a result, the employers that were kind of governing these boards moved those funds' money into the stock market. They moved them sort of into finance, moved them onto Wall Street, and invested that money just like they would invest any other pool of money, right? And what's kind of interesting is that they end up actually investing this money in ways that really deeply hurts the American labor movement and also workers in other countries.
Great. Can you say more about how it hurt workers?
One way to think about this is that as pension funds get invested in finance, we have a radical sort of transformation in where sort of firm capital is actually coming from in the U.S. So prior to this period, let's look at 1945. If you look at 1945, the year right before the establishment of these plans, it's basically individuals and families like the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the DuPonts that control the bulk of U.S. stocks in the U.S. 1945, individuals control 93% of all U.S. stocks, individuals and their families. By the mid-1970s, it's actually pension funds administered by, institutional investors, fiduciaries, that become the largest pool of equity anywhere in the world. By the mid-1970s, pension funds alone control about 25% of all U.S. stocks. So you get this massive shift in where firms are getting their capital from, and increasingly it's pools of workers, essentially deferred income, right? It's the income that they're going to get when they retire, and so they invest this money into the stock market, but as a result, actually, these funds grow very large. They went from having about $26 billion in 1952 to about almost $11 trillion by 2007 before the crash. So one reading of this might be, well, that was a sound financial decision. They moved their money into Wall Street. They invested like other Wall Street investors. This was a wise decision. It doesn't turn out to be totally the case. This basically tied workers' retirement livelihoods to financial markets. So funds have actually, as financial markets have gone up and down, as we've seen volatility there, we've seen volatility in the health of these funds, and some have actually fallen apart because of it. But on an even deeper level, the funds were invested in those companies that could guarantee that were generating the best returns on their shares. And those actually turn out to be, on balance, more anti-labor companies. So it's companies that end up getting invested in, a large chunk of them are actually companies that are moving more and more of their operations overseas, that are employing very low wage labor, that have very exploitative labor regimes in other parts of the country, also in the U.S. They're investing in corporations that they themselves could not organize. So the UAW and the International Union of Electrical Workers had about $61 million in their pension funds invested in Texas Instruments in the mid 1970s, and this was a company that they themselves were trying to organize, but they weren't able to. And so they actually, these funds are actually investing in those same companies. If you think about it like this, they're investing in the same companies that are actually contributing to the race to the bottom in work standards, both in the U.S. but elsewhere as well. It's those same companies that have anti-labor politics or anti-labor practices that end up sort of getting fund investment. And on top of this, the funds themselves actually, even if you say, okay, well, those are all issues that are not relevant to the individual who's going to be retiring. Okay, maybe it's bad for labor somewhere else, but what about the person who just wants a stable retirement income? Even on that point, they don't do that well. The fund investments end up sort of being lower than the returns that we find on your major indexes like the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So politics kind of intervenes in after World War II to turn these over into the hands of employers, and employers use these funds and finance in such a way that not only hurts workers in general, but also hurts the individuals that are reliant on those funds for their own retirement.
Great, thank you. One of the examples that stuck out to me from your book was about the Teamsters and this idea of how multi-employer funds had more capacity to be controlled than single-employer plans. Could you tell me more about that, please?
It's kind of an interesting little sub-story, I guess. One of the kind of ways in which unions got around that Taft-Hartley regulation I was talking about is if they had what are called multi-employer plans. And there's basically two different kinds of pension plans along these lines. You can have single-employer plans where usually one union is negotiating with one employer over the pension plan. So it's like the UAW is negotiating with Ford, and they establish a pension fund. But you also have multi-employer plans, and these are much more common in industries that have large unions that cover employees across a number of different that work in a number of different firms that have small firms. So usually like things like transport or the building trades, construction, you'll have unions that represent workers that work in a bunch of different firms, and I often work for small firms. And in these cases where when you get the establishment of pension funds, it's usually a union coming together with a number of smaller employers to establish the fund. Now, in these situations, what we've seen historically is that unions have been better able to control fund investments, even though the funds are still composed 50% employers and 50% union representatives. Historically, unions have been better able to kind of like divide employers or sort of like get one to join their side on an issue. And they've basically had better luck in controlling their funds. The union that has probably had the most control over its pension funds has been the Teamsters. And the Teamsters fund, established by Jimmy Hoffa, the Central States Pension Fund, we all know it well because it's had lots of financial problems. The Teamsters fund was something that was kind of controlled by unions pretty early on, and they invested in things like union construction and union projects, but also lots of nefarious things too. I mean, the Teamsters pension fund was investing in shady Las Vegas deals and casinos as well. So it's not like it was all great. But what's interesting there is that the Teamsters are able to actually control their funds. They don't use them for very progressive purposes all the time, and oftentimes their management of the fund is poor, but they were able to kind of work around this law in the Taft-Hartley Act to control their funds. And what happens is that in the early 1970s, a pension reform bill was passed uh, called, called the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. It was passed in 1974. Something that was it has been debated for a long time, debated since the Kennedy administration, and it was passed with support from segments of labor and segments of business. Labor or business weren't united on it at all. And it sort of regulated pension funds and ensure that they would be more sound. It has a lot of things that it does that I'm happy to talk about. But one of the things in particular is that it sort of regulates in more detail how pension funds can actually invest. And there's this thing called the prudent person rule. It used to be called the prudent man rule, but it's called the prudent person rule now. What that is basically it's trying to regulate how exactly fiduciaries allocate their investments when they're investing for somebody else. Because when you're investing for somebody else, you're supposed to be kind of investing on their behalf, right? You're investing their money, their assets. And what the prudent person rule does is it basically makes very clear that that investments cannot be made for any other purpose than achieving the highest rate of return as possible. So you can't use a pension fund and sort of say, I'm investing in this in worker run housing or I'm investing this in an area that's undergoing deindustrialization or something like that, because I think it's going to serve some social good. That's not the main purpose of the fund in legal terms. It's the main purpose is to sort of generate money for retirement. So the way in which this rule is enforced is basically how exactly does one know what is the rate of return that's going to generate the highest? What's the investment that's going to generate the highest rate of return? How do we actually know that? Because all investments are essentially gambling anyway. The way this was enforced essentially is by looking at dominant trends in Wall Street investment. And so if pension funds are not in line with dominant trends in Wall Street investment, which are increasingly invested in equities and in stocks with diversified portfolios, then that's a sign that the investors aren't being financially prudent. And this was essentially the law that was used to go after Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters, and when we had all that stuff where the Teamsters were taken to court, Hoffa was taken to court. That was all around issues of their pension fund and the fact that they weren't actually investing it in these prudent ways. But the net result of that, like if you kind of move away from the Teamsters story and look at how that law affected pension investment more generally, it's basically made it more difficult for pension funds to invest in ways that are seen as having a social good, or in ways that are seen as being not having a negative impact on the environment or things like that. It's further established this financialized model of investment where pension funds simply mirror trends on Wall Street. So by 2005, 2006, we see that pension funds are many of them invested in these mortgages that end up being the cause of the 2008 crisis, right? So it's had the net effect of further kind of tying workers' retirement income to these financial markets.
Great, thank you. I'd like to go ahead and shift to talking about 401ks and how that became the main model for today. Can you tell us more about that?
So you get this shift, this most recent shift towards 401ks. Which are very different in design from the pensions and the funds that we've been talking about up to now. Primarily in that they tend not to be negotiated, so unions are not negotiating 401ks and you know, if you have a 401k, it's not you and all your coworkers that are dependent on the funds. It's just you. It's your own personal fund, and there's no guarantee of any retirement income in a 401k. It all depends on how much income that fund generates. So it's much better. It's actually much better for employers. Employers like it because it's lower risk for them. If you're an employer, you set up a 401k. Usually, your only obligation is to just contribute a certain amount of money per month into the fund, and then fund managers deal with it. You know, and if the fund goes into a crisis or whatever, there's really no legal. You're not legally bound to make up for losses. That's kind of on the employer's shoulders. And in general, this fits into a larger shift towards the market, which employers have been eager to get back to since the Social Security Act in 1935. I mean, when I was in the archive, I was, you know, looking through papers in the Chamber of Commerce or, you know, National Association of Manufacturers, different sort of different corporate archives and how they saw pension system. And over again, I saw, whether it be in the perspective of individual business owners or their associations, the sentiment that we need to return to a system of retirement income, which is primarily reliant on individual thrift. Like that's what American capital has wanted. They'd prefer a system where people have to come up with their retirement income on their own. I mean, for good reason. It makes workers, they're easier to manage when they're more dependent on their work. So what happens in the 1970s is kind of interesting, because one way to think about that change is that 401ks are something that are kind of, you know, the direct result of the Reagan Revolution or something like that, like that Ronald Reagan and the neoliberals kind of install the 401k system as part of like the neoliberal program. But it actually, that's a real simplification and not really what happens. Oftentimes we think about neoliberalism and the 1980s as a period of deregulation, as a period of the state kind of withdrawing from the market and letting market forces kind of dictate how well people do and the rise and fall of firms and things like that. But actually what we find is that there was an intense ratcheting up of regulation in the 1970s and 1980s, in particular on the pension system. And the reason why this happens is that we have, at the end of the Carter administration, this growing crisis of inflation. You know, inflation rises by up to almost 14% by March of 1980. And politicians see this growing inflation as being the cause, as being caused by labor unions. They were operating with what they call the cost push theory of inflation, which is basically, you know, if you read Milton Friedman's, there'll be stuff about how inflation's all about the amount of money in the economy. Nobody believed that. Everybody believed inflation was basically about class struggle. It's about unions getting too powerful and then demanding too wages, and then as wages go up, then prices go up, and it's sort of this, it pushes up inflation. And so politicians basically wanted to weaken labor as the main means of dealing with this inflation crisis. The main way they do this, of course, is with the Volcker shocks under Paul Volcker, who was the chair of the Federal Reserve in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, where he's basically manipulating interest rates to make it harder for firms to borrow, so firms are more inclined to cut their costs and to sort of go after their unions. But for our purposes, and then there's a whole big story about that. You know, we can get into that But it's a, that's a long story. But for our purposes, one of the additional things that they did was actually increased regulations on pensions to weaken the unions that actually had control over them. Unions like the Teamsters. These were the unions that policymakers and economic advisors to Reagan saw as the main unions that were driving up the wage and the main reason for inflation. And so, so they basically increased regulations on pensions. The Department of Labor under Reagan tried to go over unions like the Teamsters, for instance, with a much stronger hand. And one of their ways of doing that was actually in pursuing these violations in pension fund management. And one of the kind of the unintended things that they do is they make the regulatory environment around pensions more and more complicated. And this kind of ironically is something that business doesn't like. Business is sort of saying, you know, why are you increasing these regulations? They're already costly as it is. And actually Reagan, when he ran for president, he ran under the idea that he was going to repeal the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, but he actually just made it stronger. He made it more robust in a number of ways. And it's actually not until Clinton in 1996 that the first law is passed that actually liberalizes, it deregulates pension regulation. So what's the effect of this, and how does this actually relate to 401ks? Well, the effect of this is that if you look at the data and you look at the cost of having a pension plan for firms, it drastically goes up in the 1970s and the 1980s. The cost of administering a defined benefit plan, in particular, 401ks are not regulated, or are not sort of, these are not the kinds of plans that were regulated by the laws that they're passing. And this increase in regulation also created a significant amount of uncertainty for the possibility of future regulation for these firms. And so what you find is that basically as regulation is increasing, albeit to sort of be used as a way to break unions, firms getting hit with these higher costs, or new firms that were being established, are disincentivized to offer defined benefit pension plans. As they see the cost of having them go up, many just say, we're not going to offer a pension plan at all. But a lot begin turning to these more individual retirement accounts like 401ks. And as a result, you get sort of the emergence of the 401k as a viable alternative to the defined benefit plan for firms that want to give their employees some sort of retirement security. And by the 90s, 401ks have totally replaced defined benefit plans. And now I think it's 70% of workers with a pension plan have just a 401k or a defined contribution plan. So they were kind of the inadvertent outcome of politicians trying to break unions in a way and deal with the inflation crisis.
Great, thank you. So just to wrap up the final chapter of your book, I would like to bring it back to something that we talked about earlier, this idea that the welfare state is a system of social stratification, and how this sort of transformed the pension system we have today. So where do you think we go from here?
That's a really good question. On the issue of being welfare states being systems of stratification, I think what we're seeing is a shift. It's a decades long shift, but I don't see us changing course any time in the immediate future. A shift towards a system which is more and more reliant on the market for retirement security, and this I think is it rings true of a lot of our other policy areas as well. And that's something that creates stratification within our workforce, because one, the people that need these benefits the most because they don't have the money are the least likely to get it. The risk that's associated with losing a job, with being all of a sudden coming into financial hardship, is sort of shifted from employers onto employees. And as a result, I think it creates a lot more precarity. It creates a lot more uncertainty for people going into retirement. And so the 401k as I see it, 401ks are kind of, they're not the, if we continue to follow the trend we're following now, they're not the end point. They're really, you know, maybe the second to last step before we get to a system of individual thrift, where people are sort of have to be fully reliant on their own savings, their families. You know, maybe you have a rich uncle or something who can, you know, help you out. That I think is where we're going. But I don't think that's an inevitable outcome. I think there's history shows that there are sort of moments in which ordinary people can actually force policymakers to do things to establish more solidaristic welfare systems. But I'm not sure if that's going to happen anytime soon. Hopefully it does.
Thank you, Michael, for speaking with us today. It was really a pleasure to talk to you more about your book. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're currently researching or working on?
And I should just say thank you to you too, Sarah. I've had a good time talking to you. Yeah, well, I'm starting to develop a project on finance. And finance more broadly, trying to figure out a way to test whether financialization actually increases the capacity of businesses to influence politics. But that's at a pretty early stage. Hopefully I'll start to get into the real research on that sometime pretty soon. That's very long term. Other than that, I've just been doing various kind of op-ed type writing and doing stuff for the book.
Great, that sounds like a super interesting project. Thanks again, Mike, for being on our show today.
Thanks, Sarah.